The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week, Neelie Kroes predicted a world without ACTA. What will happen to the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement now that the European Commissioner for Telecoms and Technology has effectively given it the kiss of death? We're speaking with Gabe Weinberg, founder of DuckDuckGo, about why his search engine is threatening the foundations of the way that we have learned to navigate the web. Charles Arthur takes on the tsunami of online porn and says that the government is wrong to point the finger of responsibility at ISPs. We gaze into our crystal ball at what will happen to the inflating egos in Silicon Valley after Facebook floats for a record starting price. And we look even further down the line with Eric Rosenbaum, the founder of Makey Makey, the computer interface of the future. Joining me in the studio is Charles Arthur, and this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Charles, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA for short, is a multilateral piece of proposed legislation aimed at curbing copyright infringement around the world. It has been dogged by controversy. In January, the European Ratification Committee lost its rapporteur, who described it as a masquerade, and protests against the treaty erupted in countries around the continent. Is it falling apart?
It certainly isn't looking as though it's going to get through the European Parliament, which is really what it needs to do. And it looks like a number of countries, including Poland, are not going to ratify it as it stands. And given that it's taken them years and years of negotiation in secret most of the time, I don't think that they're really going to get it through as it stands at all.
It has been going for an awfully long time. 2006 is when the discussion started?
Something like that. And serious discussions started to surface in 2009. But the actual content of what was in this really only started to pop up in the last year or so.
And what actually is the content? How do they propose to curb copyright infringement?
Well, it's not just about the internet. It's also about things like pharmaceuticals, consumer goods like handbags and so on. Really what it's trying to do is to create a cross-border framework of legislation so that if someone from one country brings fake goods, with the intent of selling into another country that are made in a third country, then there is some sort of framework under which you can carry out the, you can decide, or even just in the country where the import is happening, you can decide, to go ahead with the prosecution, because previously it would have been a bit complicated. So it's really about trying to bring all those things about intellectual property together under one framework. And the difficulty, though, has been that the internet side of it has really overwhelmed a lot of the other stuff in it.
So was it the internet stuff, as you called it, was it the internet stuff that caused so much controversy, so many protests in the street of Poland?
Oh, absolutely. That was really a key part of it. The internet element to it was about regulation of sites that were used for widespread copyright infringement. So it would have had an impact on sites like Mega Upload, would have had an impact on sites like Pirate Bay, although you may observe that those sites are already being hit by bans, at least in the UK. ISPs have been told to ban connection to the Pirate Bay, and Mega Upload was taken down by an FBI operation earlier this year. So there's a question about to what extent ACTA would have made any difference. The law sort of existed already. So the whole thing was that the internet side of it really did take over. You could ask, whether the issue of the pharmaceuticals and the fake consumer goods, or the non properly branded, the counterfeit goods, whether that's actually the more important part, which should actually be left to survive and just cut the internet bit out.
What's interesting about this, I find, not just the way that a lot of it has been negotiated behind closed doors and it's not been a particularly transparent process, is the countries who were involved in the ratification, who are involved in the negotiations, they're very much developed countries, and we aren't even seeing countries like the BRIC countries represented, Brazil, Russia, India, China. I'm not going to cast aspersions, but it seems to me that a lot of the goods that people are talking about are made in these countries. Why are they not involved in the negotiations?
They sort of had the chance through the, I think there's been a WTO, World Trade Organization involvement with ACTA. But certainly, I mean, the whole lack of transparency and the lack of visibility of the whole negotiation process really has been, one could argue, the reason why it's failed now, when they thought they were at the finishing post, the politicians who are behind it. They discovered that actually democracy tends to have a say in these things.
Well, if you want to search for more information about ACTA, you could use Google or AltaVista or Bing or Blecko. Or what about DuckDuckGo? DuckDuckGo is a search engine you might not have heard of, but it's seen a dramatic rise in the number of searches using the service since January this year. Gabe Weinberg is the CEO. Now, Charles, you spoke with Gabe this afternoon, and you began by asking him, what makes DuckDuckGo different?
We try to concentrate on things that the bigger search engines don't for a variety of structural reasons. So those have been real privacy. We try to give our users privacy when they're searching. Way more instant answers. So when you search, we try to give you something above the results that answers your search right away. Way less spam and clutter. So we get rid of all those irrelevant sites with just ads on them. And then a just nicer search experience overall. We try to be kind of like the Apple of search engines.
So do you know anything about the demographics of your users or what sort of age they are, where they're coming from?
You know, we're not tracking them in the traditional sense because that's part of our privacy policy, so we don't have detailed demographic information, but we do have some kind of indirect signals like people writing in feedback emails and, third-party kind of traffic aggregators telling us about our user base. And so from that, we gather that. We have general mainstream audience, but we have some groups that are higher than others, and those groups have been tech adopters, kind of early adopter tech types, college students, who I think find our brand a bit hip, and then librarians, K-12, elementary, primary school educators and librarians who find it easy to teach kids how to use search engines because of our instant answer box, and then an older crowd who find it easy to just type in information and get readable answers back.
So I guess an obvious question that I think we have to settle before we move on. Why DuckDuckGo?
Well, I wish I had a better answer for you. To be honest, I'm not that great at coming up with names in general. My last company had a very literal name, and I was on a walk one day with my wife, and it kind of popped into my head, and we both liked the name, so we just kind of went with it. I think it was even absent of what the company was at that point. But then it seemed to work well for a search engine, so we just went with it.
Okay. You've seen quite an increase in traffic, particularly this year. There's a page on your site, which is traffic.html at duckduckgo.com, which suggests that you've had a really very big increase in traffic. Are there any particular points that you think have led to that increase?
Yeah, it's unfortunately not a one thing, so it's not an easy answer. But at the beginning of that traffic ramp up, if you look at the graph, we had a visual redesign, which made our site just a lot nicer. It's probably 100 little things we changed, and that increased the percentage of people who stick on the site when they try it out. So that is some of the uptick there. And then we had a lot of kind of press about us. Much of it in reaction to various things around privacy that either Google had done or just in general around privacy, because there was a National Privacy Day, and there was a lot of articles around that topic.
And I guess the next question one has to ask is, how do you make money? Okay, so you're doing a lot more searches, you're serving a lot more people. How, though, do you make money in a world where Google has really got a lock on it through its AdWords feature and the auction model, which means that if you don't have a greater number of searches than them, you cannot underbid them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, so Google does have a lead in that. The second player in that is the Microsoft Yahoo Search Alliance. Has the kind of second biggest share of advertisers. And so we're actually syndicating their ad feed. One of the smaller, players who does that along with ISPs and other people who have a bunch of search traffic. So the way we make money is traditionally is pretty much the same, except we just show a lot less advertising.
Is that a robust model? One gets the feeling that Google is, sucking the air out of that sort of room.
It's robust in the sense that search ads are very lucrative, Google is definitely making a lot of money. But so, Bing gets about arguably, 50 cents on the dollar from what they charge in comparison to Google. So it's nothing really to shake a stick at.
What about the way that you build your algorithm? How do you do this? As I understand it, you're very much into open source, open algorithms. Do you build your search index the same sort of way?
Yeah, we have kind of an interesting approach. We're a hybrid engine, so we use lots of different external sources in addition to various things that we've cooked up ourselves. And so when you search for something, we try to identify kind of what's the best source for that. Especially in the instant answer piece. So if it's a local thing, it might be Yelp in the U.S. or Kype in the, I don't know if you pronounce that actually, in the U.K. And we'll try to route it to that source and bring back the data and show you that. So that piece, this instant answer piece, we've just recently open sourced even more. And so developers can now write plugins for that on top of DuckDuckGo. And so if you're very knowledgeable in a particular area, and you know the best sources for that area, you can actually help plug in that source and improve the search results in some niche area.
What about the argument that the only reason that you're able to keep spam out of your index is that you haven't got big enough yet to interest the spammers? That the reason why Google has to spend so much time rejigging its index is that it's so big, so popular, that it's valuable for spammers to game it?
All search engines really have that problem because people are trying to game Google, but that just means they're publishing pages on the web that people want to search. And so we also have to look through those same pages to give you good results. The answer has been for us is we're just way more aggressive at getting rid of those pages.
And Google's mission is to organize all the world's information and make it accessible. How would you describe DuckDuckGo's mission?
Early on, I would say, and I still think it's true, but it's often hard to, I haven't found a better phrase for it, but to find you information faster with less mental effort. It's a distinction from organizing all the information because, that can create all sorts of clutter. Then you have to wade through it. And so what we want to do is be able to give you, the information you want as quickly as possible without having you to mentally kind of sort through it and click forward and back on a million links. And so that's where this whole instant answer piece, where there's a readable text above traditional links, comes from.
Gabe Weinberg of DuckDuckGo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Prime Minister David Cameron announced last week that the government intends to begin a consultation about how to stem underage access to online porn. He's considering an opt-in system when signing up for an internet access package that would filter the web at the ISP level. The announcement has, perhaps unsurprisingly, been met with criticism and cynicism in the tech community, although it has received the backing of MPs from across the political spectrum. Charles, you wrote a rather spicy piece on this topic.
Spicy?
For Comment is Free. I quite liked your, I liked how you worded your things. What is the proposal on the table here?
Well, the proposal is rather as you set it out. It's that when people are signing up for a new account with an ISP, which could involve when you move house, though fewer people are doing that these days, that you would essentially tick a box or untick a box saying, yes, I want to have porn filters applied to my setting. That one for Dan Cat there. And the idea is that this would mean that if you have kids in the house, then they wouldn't have the evil, filthy porn coming into the house.
It's also saying, yes, I want to look at porn.
Well, yes, it's sort of interesting, isn't it? And you can imagine that would be quite fun for Anonymous, you know, the hacking group, to say, hey, look at all these people who are looking at porn, sort of thing. I have to say, though, that for the people who are opposed to the filtering measure, I think that in terms of political arguments, framing it as don't stop me getting at the porn is not the best way to do it. The way I set it out in the Common is Free piece was to say, what you're talking about here in the idea of filtering the internet is an impossibility. How do you do the filtering so that your child does not come across, you know, how can you do it so that your child is able to research their biology A level or O level at the same time as, you know, it's, you know, how do you not screw it up? It's effectively impossible. You know, you think about the Facebook and the breastfeeding and how AOL was all these sorts of things with people from Scunthorpe trying to sign up. It's just not feasible. And if you accept just for a moment that the internet is all about making access easy, which is what it does, then you start to get the idea that what you need to do is to educate parents. And although that's not an easy thing to do, because for better or worse, a lot of parents find it difficult to work with their children and to sort of educate them about what content is out there. The reality is that you have to. I mean, it's not as if you were going to a brand new field or something. If you went to somewhere in the country with young children and you had been told that there were sort of slightly wild animals around, you wouldn't just let them run off. So it's rather the same. You've got to think about it as a rather untamed landscape and educate them about what you're doing.
However, it seems that quite a number of people are keen to have this regulated from the top down, and they're seeking the arbiter of our social moral standings, i.e. the government in this case, to met out some kind of punishment or at least help them with a framework. You know, arguably, people are afraid of this because they don't actually know what's out there. They hear the horror stories. They hear all of this out there. And so why shouldn't it be that somebody who has better knowledge of this, i.e. the ISPs, should be able to go out there and should have the authority to go out there and filter something and take that responsibility off you? You know, it's not a lot of time in the world, and why should you have to learn about all the online porn that's out there?
Well, there are lots of filtering systems that you can download and that you can get for free in many cases to put on the computers, and it doesn't take much searching to do that. There are logging systems generally which you can get on computers so that you can say to your children, look, you know, the computer is yours, you use it as you like, but equally be aware that I'll know what you've done. So I think that doesn't count then as spying. That counts as sort of informed use. And there's a sort of a fine line, but parenting is full of fine lines between what's the right thing to do and what's the not quite the right thing to do. So I think that the sort of the desire to have the technological solution to porn is the sort of the desire to just fend, just to shove it off onto someone else, in effect. It's, and the desire for a top-down solution where ISPs are told not to do this is again, is a sort of a, let someone else do this hard parenting thing because I find it just too complicated. And there have been some bizarre arguments, such as one which I think was put forward, which was that ISPs make lots of money out of sex sites. Never in my life heard of any ISP making any money off a sex site. I mean, there are some filters in place. BT has one called CleanFeed, which is put there to prevent access to child pornography sites. And BT puts a lot of effort into that, and a number of other ISPs subscribe to it. Even so, that doesn't stop a number of prosecutions every year of people who have accessed child pornography. So, even there, with a filter which arguably is absolutely the most important filter, where you would have thought that it should be pretty clear what you're trying to do, it doesn't prevent people getting at content that you really don't want them getting at. So I think that the filters thing comes up again and again. And again, the people who know about the technology say, can't be done, try a different solution. And I think the David Cameron actually pushing it off to a consultation is a wise thing to do. He's not trying to say, yes, okay, we should do this. He's actually, you know, taking the cautious approach of kicking it into the long grass.
Well, one of the solutions that you proposed in the article is rather than letting kids have computers or TVs in their bedrooms, have it in a public place. And actually, this is something that Dr. Tanya Byron recommended in her review of the so-called dangers of digital technology that was published, I think it was 2007 or 2008. Why do that? I mean, isn't that... It seems to me that the default would be that kids have, you know, computers or Xboxes or whatever in their rooms, simply because that frees up the device for other people to watch or play with or interact with a computer or a TV in another room.
Well, children tend to demand their own space increasingly, and you know, as they get older, they want to have things that are their own and spaces that are their own. And it becomes, you know, more difficult as a parent to persuade them not to. But equally, you know, sometimes when you're the parent, when they're still, you know, not over 16, over 18, whatever, then you have to say, actually, we decide, and this is what we've decided. If you don't like it, okay, then find somewhere else to live, which, you know, can be a bit harsh. But at the end, the point of, you know, this is our space, you know, you are our child, these are the rules we make, has to be one that you sort of listen to. But equally, you know, I was having a conversation on Twitter with someone who was saying, you know, it's a naive approach what you're suggesting, because so often the parents just are absent or the parents aren't interested in doing it. And I recognize that. I recognize that you know, parenting isn't ideal everywhere all the time, but I think that the filtering solution just isn't a solution, and it isn't a solution in such a big way. And the parenting solution is a solution, you know, when it can be made to happen, that, you know, you've got to think it's the better one of the two.
Well, you can read more of Charles's opinions, and the original on guardian.co.uk/comment is free. In business news this week, investor eyeballs are on the social networking site Facebook as it prepares to float on the U.S. stock market for a value expected to be between $28 and $35 per share. Mark Zuckerberg is on a beauty pageant tour with major corporate investors at the moment, including Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch, hoping to drive up the price in advance of the IPO. Charles, how will what is expected to be the fourth highest starting price in the history of Wall Street shift economic expectations about technology corporations?
Well, I think Facebook has always been a bit different. There was always a bit of questioning about how much money Facebook actually made. And when it filed its S-1, which is the document it's obliged to file once it gets past a certain number of shareholders, when it filed that early this year, that really was a wake-up for a lot of people when they realized that it was making operating profits of $1.7 billion on revenues of $3.7 billion. So that's, you know, near enough 50% operating margin. That is pretty colossal. That's better than Microsoft does. So that was quite a wake-up for a lot of people. It'll be interesting to see how it's able to progress, because it has to keep on growing to some extent in order to make the operating margins stay the same or to improve. And some people have said, well, it needs to double and double again in order to really make itself worth the $100 billion or so it'll be capitalized at. And you know, if you remember, market capitalization is the market's estimate of the total value of the profits the company will make over its life, given a net present value. So, you know, if you sort of expect that the company might last 20 years, then it's expecting it'll probably make sort of $200 billion of profits over its life, which I think it could, actually. But I don't think that it's necessarily a guideline for other companies.
Yeah. So if Facebook is an outlier, can we actually think of it as a benchmark for, you know, a potential flotation of other services like Twitter or other services that are out there?
Well, outliers are benchmarks too. They're just sort of outlying ones. So, you know, you'd probably say, well, once you saw Twitter's numbers, you could get an idea based on how profitable it is, how much you thought it could expand its user base. You know, from those sorts of things, you could figure it out. I mean, I feel like Twitter has possibly more chances to make money. I think that it's barely begun to scratch the surface, and it's very well adapted at the moment to mobile in the way that Facebook isn't. Facebook makes nothing from mobile. So you could argue that Facebook's got a huge upside in terms of revenue, but equally, as more and more people, and 40% of its users already access it via mobile once a month at least, it could see a big upside from mobile advertising, or it might find that it just can't quite monetize it. Whereas I think Twitter is in a better place already.
Is this kind of activity, this IPO activity, and what we're starting to see, this flurry of financial activity in Silicon Valley, is this sustainable?
Oh, everyone wants to know if it's a tech bubble.
Indeed.
And when values are inflating, and they're inflating too fast, then the question is always, well, how robust is it? You know, how robust is the valuation? And like I said, I think that probably the Facebook valuation is, given a long enough lifetime, is reasonable, though Niles Pratley and The Guardian on Monday morning didn't think so. So hey, there you go. You know, pay your money or don't pay your money and take your choice. How robust is the bubble? Well, it's all about what can you get, what's the future value, how many users do you have, can you show them advertising, can you get them to pay money? It's a really hard thing to put your finger on, but there's more thinking, I think, now about where does the future lie. You know, it's in mobile, it's in social, possibly it's going to be in local in the future. I think there's some way to go yet. But I don't know what the next company's coming out for IPO. That's a really hard one to guess.
Well, as Facebook is now an internet adult, our eyes are turning to the next generation of young upstarts who will be floating in 10 years. One of the trends that we're starting to see emerge from the small fry tech startup scene is how companies that integrate online and offline, how online and offline are fusing together. Recently, I met Eric Rosenbaum, a PhD student at MIT's Media Lab, who has a novel and rather physical new idea for how we interact with the web. He's a creator of a company called, or rather a product called Makey Makey, which is an open source technology that allows you to get rid of the mouse and the keyboard and even the touch screen and replace them with Play-Doh and buckets of water. So tell me a little bit about the technology. Tell me actually what it is that I'm looking at. So to describe it, there is what looks to me like an Arduino or some kind of circuit board. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of electronic wires, mm-hmm. Leads, and then there are a series of alligator clips, mm-hmm. that are connected to these wires, and then hunks of Play-Doh. So tell me actually what it is and what's going on here.
Sure. So to start with, it's a small circuit board, and we tried to design it to look fun and friendly, and we chose the shape of the classic Nintendo Entertainment System's game controller. So there's a direction pad, up, down, left, right, and two buttons, which we chose to map to the arrow keys on the computer, and then for the buttons, the click and the space, because we thought those six things together could be really useful for controlling lots of different applications on the computer. But a lot of the things that we thought of at first were games, and so that's where the Nintendo metaphor came from. The board itself is based on the Arduino project, the open source hardware project, and so we're deeply indebted to that community for making this all possible. We're using a version of the Arduino hardware and software that is actually not out yet. It's called the Leonardo, and it has built into its software stack the ability to send messages using the USB protocol that keyboards and mice use. So that's why that part of it is able to work. We also have, on the back of the board, some feet that make it easier to plug in the alligator clips from the top by holding the board up, but they're also what we call female header. They let you plug in the wires so that you can get access to more keys. So instead of just the six on the top, you can grow into it and use a lot more on the back. And then, of course, also just by cutting a trace, you'll be able to disable the Makey Makey specific functionality of it and just use it as an Arduino if you want to. And in this way, we're hoping to create a new pathway for people into creative uses of technologies. They'll start with something that's super easy and fun and playful and simple to do, but then gradually build in complexity.
And this idea that you literally can control the computer with everything. So, for example, myself and Cory Doctorow and another person who was in the audience were literally a beatbox. You made us sound. you made sound happen through the computer by touching us because we happened to create a circuit. So it's ultimately essential circuitry.
That's right. There is a basic core idea about closing a circuit, creating a connection that you do have to understand in order to use Makey Makey. So there are lots of things to learn about as you use it, but we like to think that you'll be able to use it in a playful way, and so you'll discover those things as you go. Like, for example, what happens when you try to make a chain of people and make them into a human synthesizer? Or do different people work different ways? Can you touch their nose or their ear? It's really all about tinkering and experimenting.
How does this relate to your PhD research, if at all?
It's a great question. Well, I have been thinking a lot about the relationship between improvisation and learning, and so I have another project that's about music improvisation, and this one is more about improvisation with physical materials and technology. And so I'm trying to promote a new set of ideas about how we can view the learning process in terms of improvisation, and that ideas about improvisation can help us design technologies to support creativity and learning.
What's interesting about this is that the other project that you've just mentioned, which is a tablet-based music system that allows you to create create instruments and sequences of notes in particular ways using a screen system. This is almost the opposite because you're taking it off the screen again. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a real trend to take the stuff that has traditionally been digitized and actually physicalize it. Where do you see the origins of that?
That's an interesting question.
There's a real trend, isn't there?
I think that we will see a trend in the direction against the current hype for multi-touch and touch technologies, because they hit a wall in a literal way. You are touching your fingers to a solid sheet of glass, and that is more expressive than using a mouse has been in the past. But we use our hands and the rest of our bodies in ways that are designed by evolution over millions of years that give us lots of capabilities. So we can grip things in many different ways. We get very complex sensory information back from our fingertips. And all of those things are actually missing from the touch interaction with your fingers on glass. And so I think we'll start to see more and more user interfaces that are out in the tangible world and take advantage of the affordances of physical objects and the capabilities of our bodies to express ourselves.
An interesting cyborg future, then, that you're predicting.
Well, the idea of a cyborg is, as I understand it, incorporating the technology into your body itself. And there's a kind of gray area where it's not part of you, but you're interacting with it. And I think that's also very interesting as well. Because we have these interfaces already for interfacing between our brain and the physical world, which are, you know, our limbs, our fingertips, our senses, we can make use of the hardware that's already there, so to speak, and design really good objects and materials to interact with.
The interesting thing that you've done is that by using a technology, an Arduino board, a circuit board, and a kind of a story, a meme that's been built around it, which is the Nintendo Entertainment System controller, you've already kind of attributed certain affordances to what can be done with that technology, just by the associations that people are making with that and what's actually been inbuilt. But then you're taking it a step further by allowing people to then create their own systems around that. How much did you think about that, or is this just a happy accident?
It's an explicit part of the design process. We know that if something is generic, general purpose, it's hard to understand what it's for. On the other hand, if it appears to have a specific use scenario, then you might think it's only for that. And we are seeking to bridge those two conceptions. So first of all, we give it this look that mimics the Nintendo controller so that you think, ah, I can see what I might use that for. But then we'll also create a culture around the device where people will be creating wonderful examples, and we'll create examples ourselves that show you that the space of possibilities is actually very large beyond just the game controller, to things like making music and art, taking photos, even using your keyboard to type a status update, All of those things are possible with the board, but we think that your entry into it should start with something simple and familiar.
Eric Rosenbaum, creator of Makey Makey. That's it for this week's podcast. Links to all the stories that we spoke about this week are available at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also find out how to get in touch with us. We're back next Tuesday. I'm Alex Kratosky. This week's producer was Jason Phipps. Thank you very much for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.